Hello, this is the world's longest running football fans podcast. This is the Celtic Underground podcast and the people behind CelticUnderground.net. The football at the moment is marvellous, isn't it? Whoever came up with this fantastic tactical concept of forward passing certainly got a lot to answer for. I'm recording this just after the thumping of Dundee following on from the thumping of Hearts. Anyway, enough of that. This week's podcast is St Anthony talking to Sean McDonough. Sean has been writing online about the history of Celtic fans in Govan, something close to the heart of Govanite St Anthony. So, enough of me. This is St Anthony joined by Mr Sean McDonough. Take it away, Saint.
It's my pleasure to be joined in tonight's podcast with Sean McDonough. Sean has been doing a lot of work online about the relationship between Celtic and the Govan area, Celtic fans, Celtic supporters clubs, and just the whole relationship between the Irish who came to Govan and supported Celtic. So we're going to have a wee talk with Sean later on, and we'll be discussing the Celtic link to Govan in great detail. But firstly, as is the tradition on the website, Sean, it's just to say, can you tell us your first Celtic game you attended and who was your first ever Celtic hero?
Oh, that's a good one. First game I attended, I actually think it's a sketchy memory when I was really young. Get way back to the mid-90s. Do you remember Mike Galloway?
Oh, aye.
I think my dad took me, I've got two older brothers, and I think he took me and at least one of them to Mike Galloway's testimonial, 95, 96. So a really niche, odd kind of game to go to. I think before that, Mike Galloway had had a car crash or something really nasty happened to him. Which was unfortunate. But I was only 7 or 8 maybe, or maybe coming up to 9. I wasn't really, you know, fully ingratiated with going to home games every week, etc. So I really kind of see that as my first official home game. But when I got my first season ticket, it was Martin Neal's first season. So, you know, you're going for the 6-2 game, etc., things like that.
That's a good time to come in, then.
Aye, excellent. Although there was a caveat to that, because I was about, 14 or something, and me and my brother, Gerald, at that point, we get the cheap season ticket, because, you know, growing up in a tournament in the Carlton, it wasn't poverty, but it was money wasn't sloshing about. And so we had a seat in the Lisbon Lions lower section, which we had to give up for the Rangers fans, for the sports. So when it came to Celtic Rangers games, back then, we never go to see these games, so I missed a 6-2 game, even though I had a season ticket.
That's a shame.
Aye, but my brother managed to go, because he had some pals, and he was older, and he was like 18, 19. And he managed to get a ticket. So Mike Galloway testimonial is officially my first sort of Celtic game, I'm sure, but I wasn't going to games regularly until that season. Celtic hero, it's tough, because it's a bit of a cliche, but there's plenty. Absolutely. I mean, everybody's going to think Henrik Larsson, of course, without a doubt. But slightly more recently, somebody that I could not identify with, but somebody that I really loved watching, and I felt as though he got it off the park, you know, was I love big Arthur Boric. I've got to be honest, his personality, best goalkeeper I've seen at Celtic Park. His personality, his mentalness, for want of a better phrase, and the way he could wind up the opponent.
He was
excellent. It's often winded up people in the Celtic team as well. I remember he used to have a few bus stops with Hayden McGeady which were quite well documented on the pitch. So I'd say modern era Arthur Boric, in terms of being a Celtic history, you know, kind of aficionado and involved in that stuff, I've came to kind of take, and it ties in with the Govan stuff as well, Joe McBride. Honorary Lisbon Lion. Obviously his time at Celtic was cut short that season through,
we'll
get to that, sorry, but that's maybe for historically that one. But Arthur Boric stands alone for me in the modern era.
So you've been writing about the history of Celtic fans in the Govan area.
Yeah.
It's called obviously the Green Right of Govan. Mm-hmm. So how did this come about? Because you know there's a lot of people out there maybe outside Glasgow who maybe don't appreciate what a big Celtic following there's traditionally been in Govan through the years.
Aye, 100%. You're spot on. So really, two main reasons. Speaking personally, my thing in life is history. It's uncovering history, unearthing history, and if I see something that happens in life, I want to know how it works and how it got to that point. And I first moved to Govan 5 or 6 years ago, and I've got family there as well. I come from the East End originally. You were just saying that people outside of Glasgow don't really recognise the Govan Tim culture, which I write about quite a lot. But I have to say, being from Glasgow and Glaswegian and growing up in the East End, the shadow of Celtic Park, I had no idea. I'll own up to my ignorance. I had no idea that Govan had such a Celtic core, to be honest. Like everywhere else in Glasgow, I knew there was an Irish migrant heritage there, but I had no idea it had so many Celtic pubs and Celtic buses through the years. So when I moved to Govan a few years ago, I was struck by this, and it started to hit me. I was like, the term Govan or Govanite, the adopted term for someone for Govan, in my mind was equated to Rangers fan, Ibrox, and that's my own ignorance. And I think there's a lot of people in Glasgow, never mind outside of Glasgow, who think like that. So about 5-6 years ago, it was put into my head that no, this is actually a Celtic area. And the more I'd say that to people, and the more I'd speak to people for Govan, they were really annoyed that if they introduced themselves to maybe somebody they meet on holiday, I come for Govan. They'll say, oh, you must be a right good Rangers man. And they would say, well, no, actually. And they would need to explain it. So I thought, let's put something on paper, let's put it out in the World Wide Web and have something that you can relate to and refer to. So there's that. And also, I love history, and Govan's history is perhaps amongst the richest cultural, social cultural history in Glasgow. The last major borough to join Glasgow in 1912, Govan Town Hall. The migrants, the Irish migrants that go there, and
the Mary Barber thing as well.
Mary Barber, the red strikes.
The statue just went up down at the cross recently because of the popularity she had.
And never mind, and then individuals, Alex Ferguson, etc. And then you've got this juxtaposition to Partick just across the river, which is like a totally different world. Totally different culture, language. It's like you almost pay a cultural toll to get there. So I'm kind of fascinated by the area of Govan from a historical viewpoint, and the type of history I'm into, it doesn't have to be politicised, it's just about uncovering narratives that have been in existence but no popularised. So this Govan Tim culture stretching back over 100 years is huge, so it's to try and give it some daylight.
The one thing I found during the years is that I'm Govan born and bred. I was 25 when I moved out of Govan. I was born in St Francis Maternity
the
Mary Land Street, which is if people don't know what that is, it's quite near the old St Saviour's Chapel. So I'm amazed through the years the number of people I meet, and you say, where were you born? And they'll say Govan, and you'll say whereabouts, thinking it might be the Southern General. The number of people that turn around, there must have been certainly in terms of the Catholic population.
Absolutely.
Virtually everybody in Govan at that point was getting born in St Francis with the nuns.
It's funny you say that, because I know that area quite well. I was talking to, I wrote about Matt McGlone. The Matt McGlone edition was one of the, because he was from Govan, and I think he was raised in Tribune before he moved. That's where he was born as well, and he used that phrase.
That's my point, that's the number of folk that he meets on real.
He used that phrase, handled by nuns. But again, I hold my hands up to, like many Glaswegians as well, who identify strongly with the Celtic and the Tim culture. The term Govan has been, in football terms, has been labelled as Rangers.
This is quite a new thing, because growing up as a boy in the 70s, Rangers were always Ibrox. There was never a reference to Govan. Celtic was always Parkhead. Right?
Sure.
So it was Parkhead and Ibrox and Parkhead. But now you see headlines in the papers that say, the European team are on their way to Govan. You're like, no, really.
See, this is the time I grew up in, so this is what I've been exposed to, And I remember there was some sort of book or graphic, sort of cartoon novel or something, and it was in a Celtic show a few years ago, and it had Govan in the title, and it was referring to, it was like the Kingdom of Govan or the Kingdom of Gavania or something, and it was a tongue-in-cheek look at Rangers culture or something. And I remember, and I was living in Govan at the time, and I remember seeing that title and going, well, that's just horrific, false advertising in the cultural sense. but it's legitimising the fact that Govan equals Rangers, and it really isn't. The truth is, mm-hmm. for the inside out, I don't need to tell you, but for the inside out, the truth is that Govan has got a tremendous Celtic core. We could talk about, well, the things that I've wrote about, we could talk about.
We're going to get through it, because it's historical as well, because this is going back an awful long time. We're not talking about Absolutely. Something fairly new, we're talking about going back decades in the last century. So let's have a wee look at the Celtic connections in Govan closer, sure. then, because we'll start off with the players. Now we've got Jim Craig.
Absolutely.
So we'll run through a few of the players and fans, supporters, clubs, etc. And I'll maybe share a couple of wee stories we maybe don't know.
Excellent.
But Jim Craig, but when I went to St Anthony's Primary,
right.
which is now where Matt's got his T-shirt.
Yeah,
I know,
yeah.
That was our old classrooms.
Mm-hmm.
And every now and again, well, certainly once I remember, definitely, Jim Craig would come down and present the prizes.
Very
for
good.
For like Sports Day or something like that. So he still had a close link to the school now. Mm. There was an old teacher called Miss Thornton who was coming up for retirement age. And the one thing I always remember about her is we used to say to her, she let it slip one day she taught Jim Craig.
Right.
She never referred to him as Jim Craig, it was always James Craig. and the one story always sticks in my mind was Jim Craig's, he's retired at this point, he's a Lisbon Lions, a legend. Right?
Absolutely, yeah.
And she says, you know, all you boys that want to emulate James Craig, she goes, that's fantastic, but not in terms of his sporting achievements, because he was one of the first guys for this school to ever go to university.
Oh, well,
he got to sell a profession. Yeah. And we're proud of him in this school, not only because he's a Lisbon Lion, but because he was, in terms of his academic achievement.
Yeah.
And they're always drawing it into is that not only was he a football player, but he was a clever football player.
I think, was he also a dentist?
Well, that was his profession.
That's what he went into.
Dentistry.
I mean, there's your academia right there. Jim Craig, I mean, Joe McBride came for there as well, that I briefly mentioned earlier on. Phenomenal goal scorer, and often used quote regarding, you know, not word for word, but Jimmy McGrory.
I've got that written.
Oh, you're actually sorry, not, sorry about that.
There you go, that's how good Joe was. Because when Jimmy McGrory says he's the best striker I've ever seen, you don't get many better compliments than that.
I mean, not taking anything away from Jim McGrory at all, because he is, you know, he's cast in titanium for what he achieved with Celtic, and especially in football terms. But it's like Henrik Larsson these days, isn't it? It's like Larsson saying to you, he wouldn't be saying it to anybody just now, but it's like Larsson saying to you, you know, you're the best striker I've seen at Celtic Park. How much weight that would have in the current day. So. Mm-hmm. But even when I was doing the research, and a tremendous amount of people from the Govan area who identify, or who've left Govan, like yourself, but still identify with the area, they go in touch with us and tell me these stories about players. I mean, there's another one that I'd never even heard of until I started doing this research in this series. A guy called Matt Lynch.
Oh, Matt was my teacher at St Gerald's.
Oh, is that the fourth or fifth person to say that to me, you know, and I had no idea who Matt Lynch was, who I wrote about him in the second or the third edition, looking at the football players. Played for Celtic at quite a barren time, but he was a fairly reliable, I think he was a halfback, a fairly reliable player.
The reason why Matt played for Celtic mostly during the war years was because he was a teacher, he was one of the occupations that they needed to go and fight.
He's exempt for travel, yeah.
He admitted that to us in later years. He said, you know, it wasn't a great time for Celtic because most of the guys went away and were fighting during the war. He said, but I got to stay because obviously kids need educated, need teachers.
You kind of take the guys away. But I think he taught at Lursfarrow as well and somewhere else. Well, obviously what you were saying, but even finding out stories like that, and because I knew some of the more recent guys such as Tommy Coyne, you know, growing up in the 70s and then playing for Celtic later on, and one of the guys got in touch with us, who again grew up in Govan and now lives elsewhere, and I wrote about that in edition 4 or 5. He's got one of the original Celtic Break Club banners.
Seen that one?
Aye, which was
a
I seen that up close and was able to touch it. I mean, the thing's for 1913.
That's
tremendous.
We'll go into this later with the sports buses, but I was a member of the Govan MO for years. I was
that's
in the
right.
committee.
Aye.
Now, to see that for 1913, and it says Celtic Club Emerald.
Aye, Emerald,
you know,
is that?
That strikes a chord by me. You've obviously like Reed on it.
It's mad. And this guy
100 years ago, my God.
He's looked after it as well, and he's had it. He's just had it where he keeps it. I'm really, I don't want to say where he lives or where he keeps it, because it's worth a lot of money. But and he's a private person. But to see that up close and touch it and feel the tangible history, and as you're saying, Emerald Celtic Break Club. The guys that would have unfurled that and went on the horse and the horse drawn cart supporters, you know, aka bus known as the Brake Club, back in 1913. If you're cut, as I wrote about this, if you're cutting through probably Neptune Street in Govan, which was then known as the Irish Channel because of the Irish Catholic migrant routes there, and you're holding that aloft with a shamrock on it, and there's three players and one player on one side, three players on the other. You'll know just going to a Celtic game doing that. You're advertising your symbolism with Ireland, your symbolism with, because if it says Emerald on it, then you know it's advertising its Irish connection. It's not just about the Celtic. And Celtic is never just about the football players, as we know. It's about the Irish culture and everything else that comes with it. It was a brave man, and it would have been only men at that point. You know, it's a brave man that's carrying that down the road, unfurling that, going down the government.
I actually think they would have been hardy souls in the days.
They would have, you know what I mean? Because you've got Harland and Rule Shipyard, as I wrote about, you know, notorious for its anti-Catholic policies then, which is, you know, beyond debate. It was a policy that they had. And they're walking past that shipyard on their way out of Govan. Yeah. Unless they're going further south or elsewhere. If they're going to Celtic Park. So, the history, I had no idea that existed.
No, Joe, I'd heard about it, but until recently I'd never seen a photo, and I was overjoyed to have seen it, you know.
And I certainly never knew there was a banner that was in such great condition. And he tells me he's been offered four figures for that numerous times through the years.
Well, the hope is that Celtic will end up in a museum one day, and these things can be on show.
Because he's not interested in making money, it's just about getting the story out there. So I found out so much. You know,
there's another interesting story about Jim Craig in 1960, obviously they won the European Cup in 67. Mm. Around about 67, 68, I remember my dad telling me, and my mum wasn't a football fan, she hated football, but she went along with this thing because it was like a dinner dance thing in St Constantine's Chapel Hall, which is still there in U Street.
So it is, aye.
Mm-hmm. And there was a supporters bus left for there at the time called the U Street Celtic Supporters Club. Now, Jim Craig, being an ex-Govan guy, got to bring down the European Cup. And my dad, the sad thing is no footage it, because either they might have been surprised, or they've needed cameras then, not the degree we've got now.
Sure.
But unfortunately, there's no footage it. But my mum tells a funny story, and she said, Jim Craig came along with, they used to send one of the reserves just to give the guy experience and attending functions and stuff.
Right,
and probably company for the player as well.
Sure.
And she said to my dad one day, she goes, oh, he was a lovely boy. She goes, I often wonder what happened to him. And I said to my dad, who was it? He says, Davy Hay. But Davy Hay. Because
speaker.
He was only a reserve, you know, nobody would have known who he was.
Man.
And I always remember my mum saying that, what a lovely boy he was, because he was only maybe 17, 18. And my dad remembered, and he went, that was Davy Hay. Within about 2 years later, we were all singing his name.
Aye, Silent Assassin, Davy Hay.
So that was the European Cup, it was in Connie's Hall. So it was, but
there, as you say that, Bill.
Still there, aye, just wish there was a 40, you know, it'd be great if somebody could produce a 40 for somewhere, maybe.
Aye.
It might be out there.
Some of the guys I was talking to through the last few weeks for the supporters bus culture, for the current Govan Emerald to the Brighton bus, which was representing the Lane Alley part of Govan for a long time as well, and still going. I mean, the stories these guys are telling is most
of them. Before you get any further with the Brighton one, there may be people out there that are thinking, what are you talking about Brighton right now? I think guys come up to me and say, yous are sick, and I'm like, what are you talking about? They actually think seriously, some people thought it was the day with the Brighton bombing.
The IRA activity.
In 1984, when they nearly got Thatcher now, you're saying to them, it's Brighton Street in the Wine Alley, and they were founded in 1958, long before 1984.
I mean, the clue's 1958. That is the clue. You're talking 26 years. I can see how somebody who likes to jump to conclusions, who perhaps is better.
I think there was a few people disappointed when it was explained.
A quick Google map search will show you Brighton Street and then Britain Street, actually, just next to it, which
is confusing.
Which makes people think it's Brighton Street, but there's a Brighton Street. They guys, like the Govan Emerald guys and elsewhere, they had some stories to tell. And two of the guys from the Govan Brighton, they were original members for 1958. You know, they're in their 80s now.
Was that Paddy Parker?
Pat Parker, McCarron or McBarron, I think his name was. I wrote about them anyway. And Pat Parker, you're talking about, I think he was a convener for a long time. He's like the president, he's president these days. I was in the company talking to this guy, putting these blogs together, and people say, oh, that's a brilliant job, thanks for doing that. The pleasure I've had for speaking to people like this is unbelievable. He's seen Charlie Tully score the two goals for the corner. He was at that game, you know, that infamous 1953, I think it was. I want to say in order the retake, and then he's seen it again. He was in the corner and he was telling me about this. I mean, that's going to pass away, you know, at some point. That's a tangible piece of history. So the joy I've took out of this as well as really unearthing and showing the Govan Tim culture has been phenomenal. So it's been at both ends, you know. I've enjoyed writing it and people enjoyed reading it, obviously. I will may continue. So
there's two other guys I want to mention as well, ex-Celtic players, and that was the first one to mention. Didn't he play? He only played a handful of games, but I look upon it fondly because he was at school with me. He was a couple of years older. A guy called Ronnie Coyle.
Ronnie Coyle. I tell you about Ronnie.
Ronnie became a bit of a legend at Raith Rovers because he spent 10 years with Raith Rovers. The story I always bear in mind with Ronnie Coyle is people of a certain age will always remember the Paul McStay game at Wembley, the schoolboy game that finished 5-4. Ronnie was centre off that day. There was three Celtic players. There was Ronnie, Paul McStay, and a guy called John Sludden up front.
Right.
And in later years, when I spoke to Ronnie, he says he was the centre half for the team. So at the age of maybe about 15, he'd have been about 5'10, 5'11. A big boy, maybe no reached his full peak yet.
Sure.
But he says, I was the centre half, so I was the biggest, he says. And he says, but we're standing in the tunnel at Wembley, an England team came out, he says, and not one of them was under 6 foot. They were enormous.
Is that right?
He says, and you've got guys like Paul McStay, they've been about 5'4" at the time.
And he was thinly built, you know, for his
technique. There's all these wee Scottish schoolboy ball players, right? And they're looking at these big guys, and he says, he always remembered that. I don't know who it was, it wasn't a proper manager, it was like a schools team. Yeah. So it's maybe a guy who's the SFA guy for the schools.
Sure.
And he got them together in a huddle, and he says, listen, he says, I don't care about hate there. It doesn't mean to say they're football players. Mm-hmm. Keep the ball on the deck, do what you're good at, keep the ball moving. And that was a fascinating game. 5-4 at finish. McStay gets through.
I've heard about that.
But sadly for Ronnie, he was up against a guy called Paul Rideout, who ironically
Paul Rideout,
Rangers. And later years, and Rideout scored the hat trick. And even Ronnie says he was so much physically superior to me. He says it was really hard to quote. These English boys were men, but the Scottish boys were schoolboys. But in terms of technique and ability, Scotland shone through.
I mean, it is mad. Somebody, you mentioned Ronnie Coyle. I never wrote about him, but and I wasn't aware of that story. But I'll give you a quick soundbite to a woman who's now in her 80s, and she gave me an awful lot of primary resources and an awful lot of talking about a typical local historian. And she actually told me about Ronnie Coyle. You know, I'd heard his name, but I never knew he was for Govan, etc., and how good a player he was, not so much for Celtic, but elsewhere. So I'd had to hear that story, but like everything else, when you're writing, you know, you haven't watched the word.
Did say a story about Ronnie because he passed away, you know, like a couple of years ago. He had bad illness.
Right.
I think it was leukemia, and it was horrible that he died so young. And if you ever get into St Anthony's Chapel in the Govan Road, there's wee plaques up on the right hand side of the church for people that deceased.
Right.
And there's one up, and it says Ronnie Coyle, a strong man on and off the park.
Is that what it says? So I've been in there, so I've never seen
that. It's obviously the family put something up for him.
That's really nice. Although sad story, I never knew he passed away. But you're talking about Celtic players for Govan, etc., and I only wrote about some of them because there is so many. But somebody got in touch with us via the email. Who was reading the blogs, and it says he was in his 70s or something. He was old school Govan. And he was living in Australia or something like that. He was abroad now. But he got in touch, and he says even the amount of guys that nearly made it for Celtic, to talk about Ronnie Coyle there, he spoke about, I think, Frank McCarron was his name.
Big centre-half, even at Lourdes.
And everybody always says if it wasn't for Billy McNeil, Frank McCarron would have been
the centre-half.
That's what they've been. And such a, not so much an understudy, probably an equal, but never having the platform to do it, never moaned, etc. And Frank McCarron, I think he was multilingual. I think I might be getting my stories mixed up, but I'm pretty sure Frank McCarron was took to meet Alfredo Di Stefano as well because he could speak Spanish, and he was there in the translator capacity. But he was a government man. He was a government boy, and never made the grade at Celtic because look who he had in front of him, you know. But you know, McNeil, etc. But so much that I never uncovered, but I never had a chance to write about. But that's the nature of history.
So. Well, that brings us nicely on to Ronnie Coyle. Tommy Coyne, getting mixed up with Tommy Coyne. Now, Tommy, his dad was a member of the Brighton for years. Tommy went to see Celtic as a boy, and he came from the Wine Alley area, and the Coyne family were renowned in the area. You got famed, if you like, for even before Tommy joined up at Celtic. But I always felt sorry for Tommy when he joined up at Parkhead, because Celtic were on the slide at that point.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And the one thing I always remember is Machiavelli gets sold on the Monday and Tommy's signed on the Wednesday. And a lot of people equated that as his replacement. Now, you couldn't compare them. Uh-huh. Machiavelli led the line.
Yeah.
He was a physical player. He could do everything. Mm-hmm. Tommy very much, you made the chances and Tommy scored the goals. Tommy was a leader of the line,
poaching.
He wanted to play off people.
And
I often felt that if he'd have played in a better Celtic team, he'd have seen a much better side. He was a great player for Celtic, but he could have got so much better for Tommy.
I think he was eventually held in high regard, but as you say, at the time he came in, this is what I picked up on as well. The best memory I've got with Tommy Coyne, and again, it's to do with age more than anything else, you know. I'm watching football. My first football memory is actually when I'm not even started school yet. It's Italia 90. Right? Mm-hmm. That's my, and I remember the wee matchstick mascot guy for the Italia 90. It was mm-hmm. a wee mm-hmm. sort of mascot guy who was doing a keep you up, and watching that in the telly was mad. But USA 94 is my first real recollected World Cup that I remember the opening game, and I remember the sticker book and collecting all these daft things you do when you're a wee boy. And Tommy Coyne in the Ireland and Italy game, was it Ray Houghton who scored, I think, was it?
I don't think
Tommy Coyne scored, but he might have done, but I remember my dad talking about the workmanlike role he was playing up front, the industrious kind of role, you know, maybe not typical of his game.
It's like an unsung role.
That's exactly it, like the water carrier in a midfield sort of thing, you know, and the way he was putting himself about and running in that heat as well. I think it was a New York Giants stadium. So that, I think that is what we mentioned as well. I think I briefly touched on it in my writing, but Tommy Coyne, it's a name that everybody knows in Cumbria.
First time I heard of Tommy Coyne, I'd have been about primary three, primary four in the Ants, and they used to have the Govan Fair Cup, which was all the schools in the area, even outlying areas like Paulton or that, you know. The final was always played at, it tended to be the Ants Park, or the old 50 pitches. And our school had a good team at the time, and we go to the final, and I remember going into school the next day and the older boys were on nearly greeting because they get beat 5-0.
Aye,
and Tommy Coyne scored 5.
That's right.
I met a man for years back in Govan, Benny Carbuano, right, and he is still spun up with that because it was not in each half time, right, and apparently the Stanley's goalkeeper just folded in the second half and a close game became a rout because Tommy was good, but I think the Ants goalkeeper let him down in the day, and Benny's never recovered for that.
Right.
That's not a sore point.
Just when he says that guy's name, I think he might actually tweeted me about that game, because I think he's on Twitter.
He's on Twitter.
I'm pretty sure he, because I think that I wrote about that, and I says that he scored 4 goals, and then I think he says it was 5 goals, and I was like, oh, fair enough, fair dues, you know, and I corrected it. Was that 75, 76 or something like that, was it?
No, the reason why I remember it was around about the time of the Atletico Madrid games in 74, which was the last time Celtic go to the European Cup semi-final. And the reason why I remember it is that there was a lot of boys at my school, maybe a wee bit older than me, who their dads had promised them if Celtic beat Atletico Madrid they were going to take on. I think there was that final, I think it was Brussels,
right.
It was Bayern Munich against Atletico in the final, and I need to look that up. I think it was Brussels. So there was a lot of excitement. You were like 2 games away for the final and we didn't get there, and it was just totally disappointing.
But the Govan Fair Cup made up for it for some.
Well, I may have done in a way analogy St Saviour's, but it wasn't happening.
Still spoken about to this day, absolutely. Without us, still well known.
Now, the other thing, we can't mention the Tim element of Govan without mentioning the Ants Juniors.
No, absolutely.
People might not know this, but the original name of St Anthony's Juniors was St Anthony's League of the Cross.
League of the Cross.
What a wonderful name, right? And that was actually the parish team.
Aye.
You can imagine that a big parish in the days, yep, in their city, well, about hundreds of guys to choose, from teenagers right through to men, and they make up their Rangy Junior team, and that's been them ever since.
Mm-hmm.
They've always played in green and white. They played in the hoops.
Hoops, yeah.
Now, there's some guys that, I don't think this used to actually, but when we were boys, there were some guys used to claim the Ants had the hoops first.
They gave the hoops, that's right.
I'm not sure if that's historically correct, to be honest. I don't think anybody's really certain.
We're courting controversy here.
Have you heard that? No?
I have heard that, and I've heard some conflicting people saying, that's definitely true, and then other in the same company saying, stop talking rubbish, that's just one of the old myths. But then through the wonders of Twitter, isn't it, I suppose, I have actually seen a screen grab, and it looks genuine. For CelticFC.net, the official Celtic website, through the supporter liaison section of the website, and in that in Celtic printed media, I'll dig it out and I'll try and show you it towards the end. It says St Anthony's for governing. It's talking about the history. I think they're donating something for charity, and it mentions in that that they had given the hoops to Celtic, or so the story goes. So there's momentum for that story.
The story I heard was it only merely turned up to scout players. The juniors were a great breeding ground in the days.
100%.
He turns out and he sees the green and white hoops. And the legend is that the Willie Mealy, but I have to say that I've never found that historically correct. That was always a wee sort of fable that we were grew up with as boys.
It's a myth through the scheming in it, and girls.
It's like everything else, there's probably an element of truth to a degree, but we don't know for certain, and I don't think anybody's certain.
I tell you what, if I could find the official artifact or document historical that says that's true, that would be the holy grail for governing term history.
The Ants were famous breeding ground for Celtic through the years. You teams like St Rocks and at one end of Glasgow, and then you get St Anthony's. And off the top of my head, there's a guy called Tommy McInally in the 30s that came for the Ants, who was a bit of a legend.
Right.
Probably the most famous one ever was Bobby Evans, who came for the Ants.
And he
was outstanding for Celtic that period. And then the last guy that Celtic signed for the Ants was the late 1950s, who was a cracking guy. It was a guy called Willie O'Neill, who was a reserve for the Lions.
Right.
So when you look at that,
Willie O'Neill,
the Bears bar for
that's right. I know you're talking about.
So that's quite.
He came for the Ants
as well. There's quite a number of them, but they're probably the most famous ones.
Well, officially, I knew about Bobby Collins you're talking about, and I never wrote about him because I felt as though there's a book on him, etc. And there was quite a lot. I think there's quite a lot wrote about him, but there was. The current count, because the Ants have had, St Anthony's have had their own historians through years, it's over 100 years they've sent 64 boys that have ended up going to play for Celtic. It's phenomenal. And you mentioned St Rocks here, I'm glad you mentioned that as well, because I was originally born in Gangad, and that's where I kind of grew up for the first few years, so they've got a phenomenal Celtic tie-in as well. But I also wrote about a sort of, he never really made the grade at Celtic, but there was a guy called Quigley as well, Johnny Quigley.
That's it, and
I go on the FA Cup down there.
That's exactly
it. And again, the wonders of social media in this day and age. He's got a brother, I think an older brother who's still alive, and he's about 90, 91 years of age. And I was able to be put in touch with him. I've not followed it up yet, but he was going to tell me stories about his brother playing for St Anthony's, etc. Because he was held in high regard with St Anthony's, and he was scouted for quite a while, Johnny Quigley. And then, unfortunately, never worked out at Celtic, and I think he got farmed back to St Anthony's, and then he made his name down south. So he was a phenomenal player, and like a lot of guys in Govan for that migrant background, you know, the son of shipyard workers and the son of heavy industry workers, you know, talking about real muckle working class individuals.
Right.
So, but it's good to know there's even more. Aye, so a lot more stuff we could talk about and write about.
Now, the other thing about anybody out there who's of a certain age, well, remember St Anthony's Juniors for the old social club, which was the top of Helen Street.
I've heard about this.
Any Celtic game at Ibrox, it was terrific in Govan, because the Helen Street in Govan was the traditional Celtic end where our buses parked, and we would all walk up Helen Street, and if you were in early enough, you get into the dance club for a wee swally before the game and even after the game. and Rangers fans used to be amazed when they would pass by St Anthony's Juniors and peek in and see guys in the hoops all running about, because you know they're brought up with a legend of Ibrox and Rangers and
that's what we're talking about.
There's guys playing in green and white every week, which I think came as a bit of a shock to some of them. But the fancy pants, as we call them, I have to say they're still on the go now, which is good. They're new wee run, and they seem to be doing well, which is really good to see.
Well, I've watched them a couple of times informally, but because I've got a different partner they're playing at, McKenna Park, along Shields Road, I think. They're involved in a, they do a lot for charity as well, and they're involved in a, just like a lot of junior teams, they're trying to win a sort of fundraising competition whereby, I think it's Aviva Insurance or something like that. I got a tweet about it the other day. So if you want to check their Twitter and you check,
that's in for votes.
And you sign up, etc. And you get 10 votes, and you have to vote for an amateur football team to get covering for the fans, so you know, like a wee roof. And I just done that the other day there, and I think they're doing quite well in the votes, but they could always use more. And that's been there for over 100 years. St Anthony's, the League of the Cross, now known as the Ants, etc. Still playing in the hoops.
That's right.
Still producing talent, and if we're talking about Govan Town culture, that's that's the core of that. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it's brilliant to see them still going.
But before we move away with the players, and me and you were talking about before the tape went on here, mm-hmm. the guys out there know that the wee guy Dembele, Karamoko Dembele, hopefully he's going to be the best Dembele. So he's actually Stijn Govanero, obviously immigrants that have came here. His dad, apparently, for what I can gather, has got a job in a hospital, mm-hmm. and the wee fella stays in government. So it would be lovely to think that he's the next generation of a young boy that's going to come into the Celtic team and make a big impression.
It'd be phenomenal, because you touched on, I think the most important thing you touched on there, Karamoko Dembele, is, I mean, he's a scary talent. He's a phenomenal talent, as we all know. But again, that thing, for a social cultural perspective, the migrant family mm-hmm. thing again, you know, and that producing some
it's
sort of
almost history repeating itself, isn't it?
It is, in just like up in Garngad, up in Royston as well, famous for Irish migrants producing Jimmy McGrory and other players through the years. Stevie Chalmers was actually mm-hmm. through the Garngad as well. They've got a strong migrant community for West Africa and Sub-Saharan Africa, you know, Karamoko Dembele, similar sort of background, and they're producing talent mm-hmm. up there as well. Mm-hmm. So history repeating itself, might be a different culture, Irish to West African, but it's the positive migrant narrative mm-hmm. which is central to Celtic story, which is something that I personally love and shout out about quite a lot. And aye, for a purely selfish Celtic fan mm-hmm. point of view, you know, the talent is scary, he's excellent. Let's hope he stays and he flourishes in the hoops of the big team. And like other Dembele's, doesn't jump ship.
As I said there, hopefully he's going to be the best Dembele, you know.
Aye, I know.
So we'll move on to the fans and the supporters clubs and things now. The first thing to say is there's another wee legend that grew up in Govan, and I know this one's true, and people find this hard to believe, but Alec Ferguson, of course, was a Rangers player.
Yep.
In the 1960s, mm-hmm. a Rangers player of some renown. Mm-hmm. He didn't have a great time with him, I have to say, but he was a considerable talent. And people might not believe this, but his dad actually ran a Celtic bus for Neptune Street.
That's exactly it. Big, and it was called the Windsor, which is perhaps even more unbelievable for a Celtic supporters club to be called the Windsor. But aye, his dad was a big Celtic man, and I was talking to a local man, Tommy Anderson, in his 70s, and he knew he knows Alex Ferguson, mm-hmm. Like a lot of men in Govan and Greater Govan who grew up with Alex Ferguson, similar age, still going strong. And he told me that story about Alex Ferguson coming from a Celtic daft father family, mm-hmm. and he told it was a good line, and I don't think I'd ever managed to work it into the writing, but here we'll put it into the soundbite here. It says Alex Ferguson, when he was 10, 11, 12, he could tell you more Celtic stories than a lot of Celtic fans for that area, for Neptune Street and that, because his dad was a fanatic Celtic fan, ran the bus, and quite often Alex Ferguson, I like to believe it's true, quite often he spent time in the Celtic supporters' buses, because mm-hmm, that's what his dad was doing, you know. Mm-hmm. But he grows up and plays for Rangers, and the rest is history, as we all know. But aye, his brother
Martin was a fervent Celtic fan, so there was a wee split amongst the brothers. I don't know how Alec got to the. It's never been fully been explained. But maybe going to a Protestant school, I think
the culture at the time. Aye, absolutely.
Because you know, they very much say that the divide is in, you know, the green and the blue, that kind of thing. So the only thing I can think one is he's went to a Protestant school, and he's got in with boys that were Rangers fans. But it's interesting to note that the brother was a big Celtic fan.
Aye, I tell that, so that's definitely true. His brother as well. Aye, there definitely. You go. So aye, he's chose a line. That's fair enough. But I think he done alright for himself, didn't he? That's fair enough.
That's the last time I heard him. He's probably the most famous guy to come out of Govan. He's been a few right enough, but the one thing I'll gain his due, and he's never had his respect for Celtic. He's no, he's all got that bitterness that some of them have got, you know, ex-Rangers players. He's very much open-minded and objective.
Aye, and speaks volumes of the man as well, what he's achieved. If you were, you tend to find people that are bitter for whatever walk of life it is, only very successful. You know, it's very hard to be bitter. Or even, you know, the worst B word than that, bigoted, etc., and be successful at the same time. And he always, never met him, but always struck me as somebody that I respect, you know, all around the table, regardless of the allegiance or whatever. But I definitely came for a Celtic family.
There's a story I heard about him up quite recently. There's a cafe in London who's called the Love Cafe.
I know,
it's actually shut down now, sadly. It was a really nice
That's
place.
Right. Aye.
And Ferguson apparently, if he was ever in Govan on occasions, liked to get in there for coffee in the mornings if he was going to a meeting or something like that.
Sure.
So there's a guy I know in London who's called Alec Micheljohn, another big Celtic fan, And Alec was in his cell one day, and Alec Ferguson comes in and, right. and he says, "How are you doing?" They look that up that way. People will always make conversation.
Yeah.
Although they don't know each other.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, "I noticed that Ferguson had a beautiful black leather briefcase with a Man United logo on it and his initials, right?"
Right.
And he says, "I'm in a rush now." He says, "I need to go to this meeting." He says, "So that'll be me. I'm off. It's very nice to meet you." And Alec Michael John says, "Nice to meet you as well." And he goes out the door, and about 5 minutes later, Alec looks down and goes, "He's left that briefcase there."
Really?
So the lassie behind the counter says, "Get it to me, because he's going to come back, right? He'll take his steps and he'll come back and get it." So it was actually the next morning. Right. And he says, Alec says, "I'm in the same place at the same time," and the door opens, and Alec Ferguson comes in and he goes, "Listen, I know I was in here yesterday." He says, "Is that leather case here?" And the lassie went, "No bother." She goes, "It's behind the counter here. We've kept it safe for you. Here it is," and gave him it back. And he says, "You know something, governed people salt of the earth, by the way." He says, "You know, I knew that nobody would steal it." And Alec Michael Jones says, "Alec, you were lucky this time. You'll be lucky this time." And he actually looked into the bag, and he had the phone numbers and the addresses of the Man United players. It was a wee facsimile thing.
Imagine how much she could have exploited that there.
You know, if you'd get in that briefcase, it must have been an Aladdin's cave.
Aye.
And that was the last time I heard of Ferguson and government.
Aye, you get one shot at that, don't you?
So let's go to supporters clubs then now.
Yeah.
When I was a boy in the 70s, there was five Celtic clubs in Govan,
sure.
who left every week to go to Celtic Park or even to go further away at the away games. So I'm just going to run through them because, again, there's maybe people listening who will bring back fond memories. The first one I'm going to start with is the Brighton, because they were formed in 1958.
Yeah.
And to their eternal credit, they've kept it on the road. And sadly, now the Wine Alley's not done.
Yeah.
And they've moved up to the Fairfield Club. Absolutely. They've got a new meeting place now. So just along the road for the Brighton was the All Saints Celtic Supporters Club.
Heard about that one.
So called because they were founded on All Saints Day, which is November the 1st.
Yeah.
And that's why they took the I always should think it was odd having the All Saints Celtic Supporters Club, because there wasn't many Saints on it. You know
what I mean? A few sinners,
wasn't many Saints. So apparently the legend is that the first meeting was November the 1st, and they were looking for a name.
I've heard that.
Taking the Catholic, you know, the majority of them would have been Catholics.
Catholic heritage, of course.
Catholic heritage, Celtic then football, that's how the All Saints started. So they disbanded in the early 1980s, sadly.
Mm.
Now, my favourite bus was the one my dad took me on when I was a boy. The Govan Arms down in Govan used to be called the Fairfield Bar.
Yep.
But which is even more complicated, nobody called it the Fairfield Bar, they called it Donnelly's because the Donnelly family ran the pub for 40 years or something. Yeah. So outside Donnelly's pub, my dad would take us up, and the official name of the club was the Govan Southwest.
Yeah.
Everybody called it Donnelly's Bus. Now, they were founded in 1947, it was a long running bus.
47? Yeah,
you
go.
The I always remember their last game was the 1980 Riot Cup final.
Infamous game.
Because the club disbanded at that point. And for a social demographic point of view, it's sad in Govan at that point, because in the late 70s and early 80s, the tenements are getting knocked down, but the population is moving out and it's not getting replaced.
Yep.
So some guys are moving quite nearby to places like Cardonald and Penny Lane Park. There's other people that are moving further afield to places like East Kilbride and you know, even down to Renfrew. Linwood was a biggie because the Chryslers were still likely to go to things.
Right, so before that folded.
A lot of people moved to Linwood because of employment. So a lot of the supporters' clubs in Govan at that time suffered because, you know, there was nobody going anyway. They were still going to games, but they were moving out the place.
It's a shame because that's... social decimation there,
I know.
Antiquated housing, but you've got a lot of population displacement. Sadly, working class housing has suffered for this for decades in Scotland.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's this idea that if you're working class, Govan being a prominent working class, regardless of religion, if you're social class, if you're working class, your vote counts for less, even though there's more of you know, you're maybe disengaged with voting, etc. And so it's easy to just manoeuvre these people about. Similar things up in Blackhill, when the M8 motorway is getting, you know, made a lot of Black Hills getting demolished, you know what I mean? I put Northeast Glasgow. And working class populations with communities going back over 100 years, such as you're saying, to the point where you have supporters' buses and committees almost gone within, you know, overnight, you know, within a year. So it is a shame. A lot of architectural scarring, I think,
because Govan's quite noticeable. You can see where the old houses were because they're tenants,
right.
And you can see which the new houses, because the good thing in the last 10, maybe 15 years is the derelict land that was there, the spare land has been built upon, and there's very little derelict land left, which is good. But it's 30 or 40 years too late, because to keep the population there.
Sure.
You had to, as you were knocking down, you should have been building, and that didn't happen in the 70s and 80s. And really, the place ran into...
And if you're talking 70s and 80s, as well, late 70s and 80s, I mean, again, you mentioned the Wine Alley down towards Ibrox Stadium, the Brimland Road scheme, which is now car lots and a garage.
It's an industrial area.
I mean, that's what it is. The streets are, some of the streets are still there in name only. I mean, when houses are getting built in the 70s and 80s, it's the high-risers, and we all know what happens with these eventually. Mm-hmm. You know, people might cling to them because they've got fond memories, but they're really not the best solution. No. There's a reason why they're getting built down within 30, 40 years. So that was a group was getting built, or that was just, as you see, even worse, desolate, spare land. Mm-hmm. And that was on the back, speaking socially, on the back of the 60s, where a lot of the shipyards shutting out in the 70s and all of these things. So you've got, and Govan had to deal with rapid deindustrialisation. Then they had to deal with Thatcher, 79, 80, mm-hmm. coming in. Mm-hmm. And then they had to deal with a social demolition movement, mm-hmm. essentially, where people are then moving out of the community. And it's a shame. It takes a generation to bounce back, if no more. Mm-hmm. And that's where you have a lot of wasted community, and a lot of people suffering.
As I say, Donnelly's Pub, which is now the Govan Arms. Now, there's a few names I'm going to call it that I remember as a boy.
Uh-huh.
There was John Ford, who was a wonderful man. Tony's brother that runs the Govan Emerald.
Tony Ford, yeah.
The Govan Emerald.
That's right.
There was Jimmy Hunter, there was Linus Malley, Jimmy Mulligan, Jimmy Haggerty, Peter Scanlon. They were great guys. Now, there was two buses in the next to each other in the corner.
Right.
There was a Harmony Bar with the Govan Harp lefty.
The Govan Harp,
and there was the Donnelly's bus for there, which my dad took me on. Now, the contrast couldn't have been any greater. I love this story.
So I've heard that.
The Donnelly's bus was one of these old-fashioned London route masters where you had the committee at the back holding onto a pole going in the corner.
I wrote about that, that's
right. So that's a cracking vision. Now, they were really strict in that bus. You know, there wasn't any booze, which was unusual then.
Aye.
There wasn't any swearing, there was no rebel songs, and they allowed females in the bus, right? But which doesn't sound not much new, but in the 1970s, that was something.
It's rule breaking.
Now, I'm going to contrast that with a Harmony, who always had a single decker rather than a double decker, who were known as the Provo Bus.
Right.
Because they played rebel songs, they took flutes and drums for the James Connolly Band on the bus.
Aye.
Basically, the Republican March, or a way to park here and back again.
Yep.
And they fought everybody. You know what I mean? They were younger men, they were young boys, they were youth, you know, there was some mixture in that bus.
Aye.
They were fierce.
Aye, that'll be a total character conducing bus, that, mm-hmm. won't it? I mean, and it's people on quite aware of the short distance between the Harmony Bar and...
Aye, you thought it was 30 yards?
I mean, what is it, seconds away?
It's a free kick away.
It's nothing, but what a juxtaposition. Aye, you're right. I tell about that bus.
But the contrast between the two of them was unbelievable. The Harmony were always going to bother.
Was the Govan Harp, was that quite short-lived, or
The Govan Harp started in the early 70s. As I say, it was mostly guys at the Connolly Band that wanted to go to the games,
uh-huh.
and they established a reputation, shall we say. And they finished in the early 80s, because the Govan Emerald is actually an amalgamation of the Govan Harp and the Donnelly's bus, because there was a couple of years hiatus between it, and then a few guys got together and said, you know something, we need to start up a bus here. There's a lot of guys still going to the games,
and they need an avenue
in order to get there. And really, there was a meeting called the Tall Cranes, the Park Gate, as it was known in the 80s, mm-hmm. it's changed its name. And that's how the Emerald started in 84.
There you go, because I wrote about them quite extensively, and Tony Ford was really helpful there,
mm-hmm.
As mm-hmm. were all the guys. But I actually spoke to the guy who was heavily involved in the Govan Harp, and he was telling me some of the stories that you were just telling me, mm-hmm. there, about the contrast between that and some of the other buses.
There was one story I remember, Rangers beat Juventus one night, in the European Cup, and Celtic were that bad at the time. We get beat with Burnley in the English Scottish Cup, so
right.
We're on the way back for Parkhead, and for some reason, I don't know, I never went to the Harp very often, but my dad had me on it that night, and we just go to Paisley Road Toll,
mm-hmm.
Now Jim Baxter's pub is the old
toll bar, is it?
It was across the road. What was it until recently? Was it a Gano until recently?
I don't know. You've got what, the Grand Ole Opry in that, haven't you?
Across the road for the Grand Ole Opry.
The old toll bar, and then the Union bar, is it, or something like that, or the Union,
but,
or something
aye,
like
but
that.
It's a Rangers one now, but
aye,
back
aye.
Then that was Baxter's pub, right? And it was a popular pub because Baxter was always in it, you know, and this was his living.
That's a draw for them, aye.
So the beer coming by for parking and the buses parked there, and nobody's that bothered, and the next thing the window get turned, and it right. Came right in, you know, with a badge and the brick came in, and a wee boy nearly got hurt, and the committee on the harp were mental enough to chase the guy, and they ran into Baxter's pub. And I remember in later years talking to a couple of them, and I says, what happened? And he says, we went into the pub and there was Rangers supporters in it, and they've all run in the Celtics gear. And one of them went, we don't want any trouble. Somebody just turned a bus and a young boy got injured, just point him out. And he says, and to give him the credit, the Rangers fans pointed to this guy that just came in.
Is that right?
He got dragged out in the spot.
There you go. So you just ran in for shelter. It's the worst thing you could have done.
Well, seriously. I think he felt protected because it was Rangers fans. You give him their due, they went like that. He's the last one in.
Aye.
So,
well, I mean, for as much as there's rivalry culture and you can bring all sorts of things in, you mentioned the political viewpoints. I mean, in my lifetime, certainly, talk about away buses, supporters buses, I don't know any more than two or three stories of Windies getting planned in so-called cultural enemy territory. So that guy's biggest mistake there was thinking he was going to be all right. He should have run out of Paisley Road.
The whole thing about the harp was they chased him, or they caught him, because as I say, they were like they were all young men in the days, you know what I mean, and there was an aggressive culture in the days. Right. Music was aggressive, and you know, there was men were men, if you like.
Smell it almost, masculine and everything.
Aye. So that brings us on to the current buses. There's three at the moment still in Govan. Obviously, the Brighton is still gone. And we've got the. I need to give a mention to the Emerald because I was on it for 20 years myself. I'm proud to say that I was the treasurer for 8 years in the 90s. And
go.
One of my proudest posts is that we kept a bus on the road.
Aye.
And there was a spirit that we gathered at that point that there's something comes out of, you know, out of misery, if you like.
Aye, no, there is. Best to make you keep going.
That keeps you going, and that spirit never left us, even when we lost Ebb. Throughout the 1990s, you know, we may have been beaten, but we were never broken.
Aye, sure, and you kept going. To do that in the 90s, tough gig.
So, and, you know, I'm quite proud. The bus is still on the go now. It's probably the biggest bus, the Govan buses as well. So, again, I mentioned Tony Ford, who is Mr. Govan Emerald through the years.
Yep, absolutely.
Jerry Boyle, Johnny Ponsonby, right up to Kevin Maguire, who is now the bus convener
these
days.
Yeah.
So it's a proud boast of mine that in some small way I helped to keep the club running.
Oh, excellent. I'm grateful so. Aye.
So
I wrote quite extensively about the Govan Emerald as well. And some of the stories they guys could tell us, if you go into the kind of base in the Tall Cranes pub, these days down at Craigton Road meets Crossland Road, and if you take a wander at that pub, the stuff they've got up the wall in terms of the fan culture, in terms of the supporters buses, all the cutouts for when they went to Seville, etc. It's phenomenal, you know.
It's
a proper Celtic pub that you won't get too many Celtic tourists in there.
No.
It's a committed sort of pub. Mm-hmm. So I did enjoy that one. That was one of the best articles to research.
I have to say that I stayed in Crossland Road at the time when I was younger, and my mother and father's bedroom looked out to the back of the Tall Cranes.
Were they like a wee mural or two?
Well, the first time, in any days it wasn't even a mural. The first time that my dad saw when he opened up his curtains in the morning was Provisional IRA 1916 and 3 foot letters in green writing at the back of the Tall Crane.
Is that right?
And it might still be there. I'd love to actually see if it's still there.
Could well be.
This was late 70s, early 80s.
Right.
And it wasn't the best outlook when you're opening your curtains up in the morning.
I dare say the estate agent would have had a tough job when selling that to some people. But it speaks volumes of the culture, the political culture at the time. And there's a reason why there is, as you mentioned briefly earlier on, Irish Republican bands still active. I think there's two still active in Govan. Strong associated with the area, so
the Connolly band's still on the go, and there was one called the Govan Shamrock originally, but it's changed its name about 3 times. Is it Dockery or something?
Martin Dockery band, I think it is, and again something that is well worth the research and well worth looking into. And I think when you mentioned the James Connolly band, I think there was a
Channel 4.
I've only seen the first 20 minutes on YouTube. I think it's called something like Green Flutes or
Green
something
Flutes,
like that.
That's right.
And one of the guys in the pub was telling us it was a a Channel 4 community documentary. So they funded Channel 4 back in the days when they were just starting out, funded these communities to have a voice. And there's 20 minutes I've seen. They also speak to
it's one for
Turner.
A
it is too.
It's good stuff.
They speak, there's a guy in the documentary giving an alternative viewpoint as well. So it's no propaganda, and that way it's a good community documentary. And they're speaking about, but you're talking about the decimation, the urban landscape being scarred and that, and then they're talking about why they have these cultural, political, cultural beliefs, etc. So I've not seen it all, but the bits I've seen certainly are interesting.
I would urge you to watch it because it's fascinating stuff. And the fact is, now I can still remember when that was in the tale, it was 84.
84 or something.
So what we're talking about now, that's like
34 years ago now.
So, I mean, again, it's almost historical context now.
Well, it is. Looking back, and if you're thinking about, you know, the troubles in Northern Ireland, extremely relevant to the west coast of Scotland as well,
definitely,
for reasons that I'm sure most listeners are aware of. What was happening in 1981, the hunger strikers, etc., and the palpable sense that something had to be done about these things. For right or for wrong, it was an interesting time. Certainly wouldn't have wanted to live through it in the eye of the storm. But if people have that cultural identity and you're living in a democracy, then of course people have to exercise that. So again, something, as a person not traditionally from Govan, I had no idea about this until I moved to that part of the city, and I started finding out about this, and I couldn't believe there was such a strong Irish Republican and Irish nationalist identity also in existence. But
I remember that the News at 10 was on one night, this would have been maybe late 80s, and one of the headlines in the News at 10 was, there was trouble in Northern Ireland. Now I can't remember if it was Lurgan Alarm.
Right.
I get confused with Lurgan Alarm for some reason.
Aye.
It was the first Republican march ever in this place.
Right.
And you know, you can imagine all the Loyalist demonstrators at the side.
Yep.
And I think it was only two bands that marched, and the Connolly Band for Govan was one that marched.
Is
a lot
that
of
right?
bands pulled out because I think they thought, no.
Aye, we'll not go for it.
So they're surrounded by police, you know what I mean? And you know, they're getting hammered with bottles and stuff, and they're still playing. The flutes and drums are gone, and I burst out laughing in the living room. Because it focused on this guy, and there was a boy I went to school with, and he was banging this drum, and it says, James Connolly Band Govan.
Right, in the middle of alarm.
Right, in the middle of alarm, and my mother turned around and went, how does that say Govan and his drum? What is he doing over there for? Right, and I'm thinking, he sat next to me at school, you know what I mean?
It comes to his identity later on. I had no idea about that, but it could have been Lurgan Olaf.
It's either or, I just can't remember exactly which one it was. Now, just to get back there, I've been doing here about the Emerald Break Club. In terms of the players that I've got down here is McCall, Browning and McMaster, who must have been the great players of the day.
Aye.
You know, and again, I know we've touched on it, but to think that, you know, somebody had been to the trouble, and that must have taken the great care and great attention to I don't think you can make anything like that now.
Well, see, the guy who holds it, who has it, he's done his own research in it. I've corroborated it, and it's excellent research. There is a label, there's an artist sort of mark on the banner, Mitchelson, 1913. That's how we know it's been 1913. And Mitchelson was actually a company, I forget, it's either Tradesden or Trongy, just round about either side of the river, I can't remember. That was this guy's job. He designed flags and banners. It's like a modern day printer designing signage, you know. So Mitchelson, that designed that, I don't think specifically had any sort of Celtic leaning, but that was that company's job, was to do these fan art. But anybody who's researched the Celtic Break Club stuff, and I know the Shamrock magazine has wrote quite a lot about this, the Celtic Break Clubs were the pioneers. You know, these were the guys who were first wrote about. If you go and look at the old Evening Times for the early 20th century, the old Daily Records, the Herald, etc., they're talking about the Celtic away support. You know, Celtic
that's
almost
right,
invested
stuff,
in a way, so you know, they got a lot of support then. But even, you mentioned the three names on it, the guy McCall, I wrote a wee bit about him, Jimmy McCall, because he played for the Ants, so he had the Govan tie-in, you know. His nickname was the Sniper in 1913. Maybe not the best nickname for the First World War coming up, right? But that was his nickname anyway. And he wasn't fae Govan. He was fae, Canada doesn't exist anymore, he was fae Anderston, where roughly run about the Hilton is, you know, that it's all kind of the motorway, right? That's, he kind of, it was William Street or something. He grew up there, so shipyard family, and then he goes to play for the Ants, Jimmy McCall. and he's like their star striker, 1911, 1912, when he's a teenager. And then he goes to Celtic 1913, and he's with Celtic 1913 to 1920, and he's coming into Celtic at the time that the famous, the mighty Jimmy Quinn is just coming out of the game. So Jimmy Quinn being the Larson of his time, almost, 1912, top goal scorer, 1911. So he was like the understudy to one of the Celtic greats at the time. Just Jimmy McCall was the understudy to Jimmy Quinn. And then he becomes Celtic's main striker for a good 5 or 6 years. And he was... So the reason why I think he's on the Emerald Celtic Break Club in 1913, because that's at the start of his Celtic career. Mm-hmm. He's not really kicked in yet. I think that's because the governing towns knew him for the Ants. I think that's why he's on it. The other two I never researched extensively, but I know there is a good historian of all things Celtic called Ian McCallum, who has published a few books. Celtic, The Gathering Storm, and The Glasgow Irish.
That's it.
And it's some really, really good stuff he's wrote. And I know that he's researched these guys, and he could tell you a bit more about Browning.
I think Ian McCallum, it's either him or Brendan Sweeney who are good at...
I think he done the early years, didn't he?
The early years of the club, that's a speciality.
Uh-huh.
It's definitely one of the two of them. We're on Twitter, and it's cutting. And it was the inaugural game of the Ants. When Celtic came to play them,
right.
And they went back to the League of the Cross Hall,
uh-huh.
And it was Nathan Street at the time.
That's
which
right.
Is now the Hard Hall Scheme. The funny thing is that hall is still there. You can still see the crucifix at the top of the building.
Oh right,
but
right.
It's a carpet for them now or something like that.
Oh, is that you know,
doing it?
Old
building, it just fits itself.
Aye.
Do you know what I mean? It's totally essential.
Is that what that was?
That's the League of the Cross Hall.
There you go. They
used to call it the League Hall.
Aye.
When we were boys, right? St. Anthony's Chapel sold it in, I think it was the 1970s.
Uh-huh.
But anyway, it was fascinating. There was this cutting. It was probably for the Catholic Observer. And what happened is they played the game at the Ants Ground, and they all walked back to the League Hall. And there were sandwiches and beer and all that laid out, and people were even in the 80s, these guys were superstars. Do you know what I mean? The Celtic players that were legends, and you can imagine like an Irish Catholic community who have adopted this team.
Yeah.
And these guys are megastars, right? And apparently they all sang songs for the piano, and it was all songs like "A Nation Once Again."
Well, that's,
you know what
exactly
I mean? It was very much an Irish ethos.
And you know, it's a horrible thing when I think about the modern day hypocrisy, because what we're talking about here is a phenomenal piece of Glasgow Irish culture. And to speak about Glasgow Irish culture, even in 2018, over 100 years, you know, the Ants have been gone since 1904, 1906, something like that. Some people still get a wee bit, you know, shaky, a wee bit scared about this. There's nothing that shouldn't be like that at all. Celtic, other than being a football team, the reason why, as we all know, their ethos is so great is because they're a vehicle. You know, they're used, rightfully so, and seen as a vehicle for people identifying with their Irishness.
Mm-hmm.
Whether that's through Catholic heritage or just their Irishness, you know, their Gaelic sense of heritage, where they came from. My ancestors coming from Galway, and we all have similar stories. So that's why Celtic truly are more than a team. So... to have these things preserved and singing songs like "A Nation Once Again," "God Save Ireland" was another famous one that I've seen through the original cuttings, newspaper artifacts, talking about the break clubs would sing these songs cutting through Lanarkshire and Lough Hall, you know, and all these things.
Places.
places where I don't know if a lot of Celtic fans are always going to want to go. But again, it's about having that identity, and we still have that to this day and age. And at certain points through, even in my lifetime, some of these songs, chart toppers in Ireland, recognised worldwide, are criminalised, as we know. It's certainly delegitimised in a Scottish culture, which I always find quite shocking, because from a purely historical perspective, regardless of your culture, your heritage, your religion, you can't deny people their history.
Mm-hmm.
And when you start to deny people their history, you start to take away that person's being, who they are.
Mm-hmm.
So these songs are very important, not because they're some mad rebel tune to noise up the cultural enemy or whatever it is, because people back in the day used these songs to remember the old land, to assert themselves.
It was identity.
It's a serious thing. And there is reasons. Listen, you're always going to get idiots who sing certain songs to noise people up, but the vast majority of people sing these songs as a sense of pride and heritage. And that... For 1904-06, as you're talking about, that goes to show.
Going back to my dad, I remember him commenting that the troubles in Northern Ireland started in 69, and his take is in, obviously he was there at the time. Up until 69, Celtic fans would have signed Sean South or Dublin in the Green.
Yeah.
But it's in great terms, isn't it? Very, very offensive.
Yeah.
And again, it was a cultural thing. Rangers fans would have signed Derry's Wolves or the Cry Was No Surrender or whatever it was. So that you've two sides of the divide, he says. But once the trouble started in Northern Ireland, he says, a lot of nastiness crept into it, you know. And
it changed a
bit. And it wasn't so much the singing, it was the chants.
Right.
That were coming, you know, like, mm-hmm. that they were crass, you know, like, stuff that, you know, even you're proud of your Irish roots and you think to yourself, well,
that's too far, it's too much, or whatever.
You feel uncomfortable with that. So aye. I think that Celtic were unlucky for the point of view that when the trouble started, then I think that because so much of a fan base in Northern Ireland,
yeah,
far more, probably more so now than the South, because the South, throughout the island of Ireland, there was always a Celtic. I love a Celtic, but these days with the way things are, they're more likely been to Man United or Liverpool because they're always brainwashed with Sky Telly.
Yeah.
But Northern Ireland has stayed faithful to the Celtic cause.
Because it's always meant that wee bit more.
A wee bit more to them because they're maybe a wee bit more oppressed than they're in the South. And,
In Northern Ireland, they have a civil rights movement for a reason. I mean, if you have to have a civil rights movement in the 1960s, just before the Troubles, you know, and people can say it's hijacked by militarism or paramilitarism, say what you want, there was a genuine peaceful civil rights movement modelled on the American civil rights movement that took place in Northern Ireland because of disenfranchisement of people from specifically Catholic areas. So your football team, if you equate a football team to that sense of culture, you know, Irish Catholic background, Brother Wilfred, the whole story we know about, it's always going to mean that wee bit more. And someday, some people, quite ignorant people, are quite fond of, or maybe naive, are saying that, oh, Celtic Rangers, you know, both to blame, sectarianism.
Two cheeks of the same backside.
Exactly.
That's what the normal
say. And even without that, they will often say, you know, ban it. It's why were people that I've got mates that support Raith Rovers, for instance, and they're totally out, not even in this coast of the country, you know, although this is a pervasive thing, and they'll say things like, why are yous always bringing it to politics? Why are yous always bringing it to identity? And they're saying Celtic Rangers games, they make sectarianism worse. They make they're almost creating it, and it's a nonsense, you know. We're talking about the Troubles. Sectarianism had been documented in Glasgow for 1802, 1790s. The first Orange Hall opens up in Maybole in Ayrshire in 1801, according to historian Tom Devine. I mean, there was sectarianism since then. You know, it's way before football.
And when you're talking about sectarianism, you're not talking about two sides here. You're talking about anti-Catholic sectarianism.
You're talking about that. You're talking about religious identification and anti-Catholic. And absolutely, Scotland, unfortunately,
it was total prejudice.
Predominantly anti-Catholic attitudes, quite normal right up to the 1930s, 1940s, through employment exclusions and informally after that time as well. But people then say, well, fair enough, but football makes it worse. I disagree with that, right, and it's not a popular view, but I actually think that, you know, the phrase a proxy war, that if two groups of people are going to have a fight or a conflict with each other, they often use something as a symbol of that conflict, so it's a proxy war. So I think sometimes Celtic Rangers, people are chanting these songs and singing these songs at the football games and on the buses and in certain streets at certain times, etc, etc. I think that actually kind of works as some sort of contained vehicle.
It diffuses.
If that makes sense. And at least if it's happening at well-known pubs and well-known Celtic or Rangers streets and well-known stadiums at well-known times of the year, i.e. the 4 or 5 Celtic Rangers games will play, at least there's a heavy police presence, at least there's a heavy authoritarian presence. I'm not in favour of that, but in terms of public safety, it's no happening in the bars and it's no happening at any other different point in time.
Do you know what's interesting, you're saying that. I've got a book in there, it's called The Blue and the Green. It was written by Archie McPherson.
Right.
Now, it must have been late 80s, and it's quite a rare book now, you don't see it very often.
Aye.
Now, McPherson's in that, and he catalogues 10 famous Old Firm games from, I think the first one was just after the Second World War.
Right.
All the way through to late 1980s, but I think maybe the 1980 Cup Final was the last one or something. And he makes a couple of points and it always stick in my mind. The first one is that after the Second World War, the hope was that men that were fighting in the trenches together are basically brothers, right?
Aye, aye.
The hope was that they were going to come back and still act like brothers. and he showed you a newspaper clip, I think it's like 1946-47, and it was like 150 arrested at Ibrox because it was like wild fights out in the street with supporters coming and going for the game.
150.
And that's quite depressing to think that, you know, two years before that, maybe 18 months before that, guys are literally in trenches, are running behind a tank, fighting with each other.
Help
and
yet,
but when they come back, when there's peace, they're literally getting back to fighting. But what made me think of that was that McPherson's in it, and he makes that roughly the point that you were making there.
Right.
He says that the when you look at what happened in Northern Ireland and how serious it got, you know, you're talking about bombing, shootings, killings.
Proper war, you know.
Horrible stuff. He says Celtic and Rangers was always like it helped to diffuse the situation, if you like, because you could go for 90 minutes and like half a bit of steam. And even the guys who were quite extreme, whether it's loyalists or Republicans, had a vehicle to take out the frustrations, and yet it wouldn't lead to anything serious. You know, I'm not saying
you
that
have the violence, but low level
hooliganism, I'm not saying that that's no serious, and certainly in the 70s there was almost constant hooliganism in the 70s, which wasn't acceptable. But he says it didn't get like Northern Ireland, and it could have at one point.
It's an interesting point that it is a vehicle for it. So, and also, you're never going to have a Scotland or a Glasgow without football.
No.
So it has to be embraced and then regulated and whatever. So there's a positive to it, and I would rather see the positive to that type of culture. If the culture exists, don't try and pretend it doesn't and legislate against it, because we know what happens there. So try and embrace it and regulate it as much as you can, and allow it to exercise itself.
To stay in the historical aspect, as we were talking there about maybe about republicanism, you know, like probably a hardcore republicanism. I was fascinated by something that I found in the internet, and it said that between 1918 and 1923, Govan had the Scottish Battalion C Company of the IRA.
Which
is astonishing to think that in Govan at the time, it was fervent republicanism happening in a book.
Despite what Govan is famous for in terms of the anti-Catholic, I think, despite of that, I think it's because of that, actually. But it's something I don't know a lot about, but I know that there's a historian, Stephen Coyle, a good historian, Glasgow-based historian, who wrote a book called High Noon on High Street, and that's about early Irish Republican Army activity in the High Street of Glasgow, attempted to ambush.
By smashing the van?
Aye, that's it. And the bullet holes are still there in some of the bricks in the High Street. Phenomenal book. I've read that a couple of times. And he's wrote another book. The name escapes me just now. I think it's something like We Will Rise Again. It's just been recently promoted. And if memory serves me correct, I never seen it, I wasn't in attendance, but I think Stephen Coyle actually delivered a speech about this in the Tall Cranes, which we were talking about just a few months ago. And in that, he talks about the C Coyle, the C Company, and he's done the research, he's done...
Well, apparently the reason why I raised it was that there's documents out there, it's got names and addresses and everything. The National Library or the National Archives... That might have them. So obviously, if you were a historian, and I know that's your thing, then there might be an opportunity. I would love a look at that just to see 100%. The addresses.
I think Steve will certainly
see the names.
He'll certainly have a copy, but it'll be public access. You know, it won't be because it's.
You may actually find it online.
Even if it wasn't public access, it's coming up to the 100-year disclosure. So if it's not the Mitchell Library in Glasgow, it'll be through in Edinburgh National. I'm guessing. I don't know, but something I don't know a lot about historically, but there's good authors writing about that. And it's whether you agree or disagree with it, it's a history of your city.
It's fascinating.
You need to figure out why it happened, etc.
Obviously, coming from that background and grandparents that I can remember them telling the stories when I was a boy, but coming from Belfast to Glasgow and out in the boat. My granny was born in 07, so she came here probably about 1914. And just by fate, they ended up in Govan. We could have been anywhere. It could have been a Gorbals, could have been Toonhead, it could have been a Carlton.
Gamgad, whatever, but you have been Govan.
So obviously, maybe there was a wee Irish clique there.
There was the Irish club in Neptune Street. Neptune Street was originally known as Queen Street, and then it became known as Neptune Street early 20th century, and it's still there to this day.
Much left now, but
I was going to say that there's a modern school campus there, and then there's Orkney Street, I think, adjacent to it, and you've got the fire station. And at the top end of Neptune Street, there's some social housing at the Boatmen towards where the winery would be, towards Roman Road. Then I think it's pretty desolate, but that was known as the Irish Channel, and that was overcrowded houses with Victorian housing, jerry built housing, and that's where the Windsor CSC, which Alex Ferguson's father was a convenery, and that is also where for a time in the 1920s and 30s there was the Irish Club. So Neptune Street had an Irish Club in Govan, so there was a serious Irish culture alive and well in Govan. And there's another sociologist and historian called Sean Damer who's still going, and he wrote a book about the Wine Alley.
That was something I meant to raise with you actually, because that was in the 70s.
I've spent time in his company. He's a good, he really knows his stuff. And
he was Irish, wasn't he?
No, he's Scottish, but his mother and father were Irish, so he's an Irish migrant, son of an Irish migrant, East Coast originally, moved through to Glasgow, and he spent a good 6 months at least, I think, doing what's known as participant observation or social anthropology, living amongst the people he's studying, and he was open about it. You know, he stayed in a tenement.
Apparently it's a great book.
I've got a copy. It cost me a penny. It's out of print, but you can get second hand copies, not easily, but quite cheaply, if you know where to look. And he's still going, Sean Damon, he's still writing, and he talks a lot about in the 1970s when he was living there temporarily, the Irish accent in Neptune Street of the 1970s, or certainly the Irish culture and heritage was alive and well, and people used to speak fondly about the Irish Club, which by this point in the 1970s was shut down, but it was there. And again, when I was reading that book, it's an excellent book if you're interested in working class housing and working class exploitation and labelling and all of these things. But he's got primary source footage and recordings in that of interviews he had with second and third generation Irish families in Govan, because he's speaking about what it's life is like to be a Govan.
I think he portrayed a community spirit which was very much to the fore in the days. And as you know, as we've already discussed about the housing, when the council and their wisdom decided to basically raise the place to the ground, and people start moving it to different areas.
Well, he also spoke, and he also spoke about how some people in the Winey found it in the 1930s when they first went they found it difficult because people in Govan were kind of looking at this, what was known as Moor Park and known as the Wine Alley. They felt as though they were going to get that housing. So they were kind of promised by local councillors that they were going to move out of the Victorian tenements, the former slums, into this new 1930s housing stock. But it was people for the Gorbals, and it was people for the Calton, and it was people for some people for Govan getting into the Moor Park. And the local media machine, the Govan Press, which is now no longer going, and their building still stands.
That's right, that's Road. A beautiful building.
So it's got Robbie Burns and
all the heads on it.
One of the guys, the statuettes in it, is the guy Gutenberg who invented the modern printing press or something like that. The Govan Press, unfortunately, and I say unfortunately in terms of humanity, is that they one of the chief editors for a long time was quite anti-Catholic, a guy known as Brochi, and this is fairly well known in Glasgow history, and he's got a book, A History of Govan, and there's a few comments he makes in that book going way back, which is quite negative towards the Catholic and the Irish community. So I think the Govan Press as well, we're speaking about Govan being known as perhaps no, the most forgiving to a Tim culture or an Irish culture. The Govan Press was certainly part of that narrative for a long time. But of course, as I've been writing about, the Irish and the Celtic and the Tim culture of Govan is huge.
Well, it's worthwhile pointing out that that you had three Catholic churches within a fairly small radius.
That's something again. You've
got the Connies up at the Elder Park end. You've got St Anthony's Chapel, which is the mother church of the area because it was the first one. Doing the cross at the Lyceum, and then it's away now, but St Saviour's was up next to the Winey.
And St Saviour's, I'm sure, is still a school there, still a primary school, still a new building, etc. But the church is away, so. If you don't, you know, and the whole point of me doing that writing specifically, other than writing about history, which is something I like to do, is was to highlight that this is a phenomenal, palpable Irish and Celtic culture that's there, because most people just equate and govern with anti-Celtic or historically
just being a Catholic area.
That's essentially being that. Some phenomenal Irish and Celtic, whether it's political, social, cultural history coming from.
It's a rich area in terms of history and.
I'd say for the divide and the split, maybe unparalleled in Glasgow terms, you know, because every area, Gorbals, Garngad, Calton's get phenomenal history in other places, but in terms of having that almost manic split you know, being known as anti-Catholic, but at the same time having a strong Irish Catholic identity. That government is fairly unique in my eyes for that. So,
so we've been through the players, we've been through the supporters clubs, we've been through the republicanism, Catholicism, you know, we've done a lot. So aye, it just remains to ask you now, what's your next... what's your plans now?
I know I should have said this first, but no, you're quite right. I know, good stuff to talk about. Plans now with the Green and White of Govan. So the mini series is finished. The blogs that I was writing, very well received on social media as well.
So for people that are listening, maybe want to...
You can check that. There's a website, seanmcdon.org, or just Google the Green and White of Govan, and it will come up. I've got a Twitter presence, seanmcdon_org as well. That is all there. Check it out, please. So that's there for all time, because it's online. There's 7 or 8 parts to that. There's 8 parts to that, but 6 editions are really researched. The first and the last edition are introductory and conclusive. So that's just came to an end. But because people were interested in it and enjoying it, in order to make a deeper legacy, the next plan over the next 6 weeks, hopefully before Christmas, is to turn this into a tangible one-off commemorative magazine, actually.
A wee brochure.
So I'm speaking to printers just now and trying to get quotes, etc. I'm quite creative, but I've got no interest in learning graphic design in the space of a week, so I'm trying to source some Celtic sympathetic graphic designers as well. But in all seriousness, the next 5-6 weeks I'll be keeping people up to date on Twitter and on the website. That'll be a tangible thing. At least 100, maybe 200 copies made of it. It's not going to be mass produced. The aim behind this isn't monetisation or profit. That's got to be coming into it, because when you're just typing up a blog, it doesn't cost you anything but your time. And I actually gained it. I profited from the culture and the community and the stories. But when you're having to get things printed, you need to monetise it, otherwise you're going to go bankrupt. So it'll be a £10 one-off commemorative magazine, and 20% of all proceeds are going to go to a Govan-aligned charity or not-for-profit, because what I've put together is a people's history. I've not wrote this. I've put this together. It's always been there. I've just put it together, and hopefully other people start to do it as well. So it's only right that some of the stuff should go back to Govan. So allowing for costs and all of that, hopefully this thing will be ready to rock and roll for mid-December, just in time for Big Santa coming.
Well, hopefully there may be somebody out there that's got a photo of the European Cup in the Connie's Hall. That would be, as I said, my man Darryl there that night. Well, you never know.
You'll remember it, at least.
But as I said there, he was unknown at the time. It's kind of funny to think that a Celtic legend was there and nobody knew who he was.
I've never heard that story as well, so that's certainly something. And I should say as well about this magazine, somebody might be listening going, what's the point in that? You've got them all online, everybody's read them, you know. That's true, but I'm going to put in at least 2 new articles, possibly 3, and the amount of things that people have shared me, such as these conversations, what they've sent me on Twitter. Some people have got original cuttings for, you know, their dad at a Celtic game, on the Govan bus, whatever, and they've shared that with me. I'm going to put this in it as well, with their permissions. And there's going to be a new article about the fan stories that I heard for the Emerald and the Brighton that never made the first cut. I'm going to put that in here. We spoke a lot tonight about the historical, the Irishness, the politicisation, the republicanism. Speak about that from an academic perspective in terms of why that is there. You know, the two bands to this day still going strong. So I'm doing research for the next 2 weeks for that. And then hopefully by that time I've sourced a printer and all of these things, and then get it sent away and get it sent out.
Well, if there's anybody out there listening and that's got anything that they think would be of interest to you, then I would urge them to actually get in touch with the website or get in touch with yourself. You'll be able to certainly pass them on. So
appreciate that. Yeah, that'd be excellent.
Apart from that, just to say thanks for your time, and as an ex-Govan man, it's been an absolute pleasure talking about the old
thank
times.
Thank you very much. Aye, and as a new Govan man,
good man.
Cheers.
Sunshine. Hope you enjoyed that podcast. I need to definitely get some stuff chatting about the games coming along soon. I've had some really interesting chat with Mark Cooper, and Andy Hallboy recently about a couple of things that I think we'll get on the podcast and we need to cover before the AGM coming up towards the end of this month. Even though our figures are much better than the Rangers figures, the thing is on the park, and even though we're performing better on the park than Rangers, dramatically better, we're not comparing ourselves there. We've got to be looking at Europe, and we'll be chatting about a couple of things to do with that. Anyway, enough of me. As I say, hope you enjoy the podcast. This is me, Harry Brady, saying good night and God bless. Good night.
All the while, in this world where we live, there should be more happiness. So much joy you can give to each brand new bright tomorrow. Make me happy through the years. Never bring me any tears. Let your arms be as warm as the sun from up above. Bring me fun, bring me sunshine, bring me love. Bring me sunshine in your smile. Bring me laughter all the while. In this world where we live, there should be more happiness. So much joy you can give to each brand new bright tomorrow. Make me happy through the years. Never bring me any tears. Let your arms be as warm as the sun from up above. Bring me fun, bring me sunshine, bring me love, sweet love. Bring me fun, bring me sunshine, bring me love.